What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Brooke Goldstein, the founder and executive director of the Lawfare Project, a legal think tank and litigation fund upholding the rights of Jewish people and the pro-Israel community worldwide. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mevina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Hanukkah begins tonight, first of 8 nights of this beautiful festival of lights and latkes. Every great holiday begins with a story, and the Hanukkah story itself is an incredible true tale of the victory of the weak over the strong, the few over the many, the faithful over brutal autocrats. The Maccabees' victory nearly 2,200 years ago was especially a victory for religious freedom that saved Judaism and in essence made possible all of Western civilization. The best story of Hanukkah that I know took place in Billings, Montana in this season, a week or two before Hanukkah then, in the winter of 1993. It culminated during Hanukkah. That story, while it is now 26 years old, seems particularly relevant right now, this year. I'll explain why in a moment. Billings is the largest city in Montana, which doesn't really have cities. About 110,000 people lived in Billings back in 93, a high plains town on the banks of the Yellowstone River and the bluffs above it. Its economy based on cattle and some oil and a few other things. People in Billings fly fish and hunt and enjoy the rodeo. Jews do too. And there's a nice little symphony orchestra, and some good restaurants, a reasonable college, a modern and efficient airport, a good life. The Little Bighorn is only about a half hour away across the Wyoming border, and there are many Native American reservations in the area. There have been Jews in Billings, Montana, since the 1870s, and the first and only synagogue, Beth Aaron, dates back to 1919. I say that there have been Jews, but in truth, not very many of them. The congregation, when I was there, numbered around 50 families, too small to have a permanent full-time rabbi. And in those days, student rabbis flew in every other week from the Hebrew Union College Rabbinical Seminary in Cincinnati to serve their religious needs, which were in any case modest. In the winter of 1993, that student rabbi happened to be me. I flew in two planes, 6 or 7 hours each way through Salt Lake City to get there every other Friday and then the reverse trip Sunday. I'd conduct services, teach kids and adults, stay in somebody's home, and be the acting rabbi. The Jewish community of Billings was a laid-back bunch, felt itself to be very much part of the community and society. Some were members of the Yellowstone Country Club. One conducted the symphony. He later became a rabbi. All had lots of friends in town. They were doctors, shopkeepers, business people, teachers, mechanics, car dealers, professors, and a lawyer or two. They were very nice. And then, shockingly, around the High Holy Days, there were anti-Semitic incidents, one or two. A swastika drawn on the ground outside the temple, hate literature circulated against Jews. No one really knew what to do about it. The Billings community had never experienced anti-Semitism to any degree, and it shocked them. They called the Anti-Defamation League office in far-off Seattle and got some decent advice. But then, in late November and early December, two prominent temple members whose homes were decorated with menorahs and dreidels and drawings of Judah Maccabee and other kids' Hanukkah decorations, you know, Billings is the kind of town where everybody decorates for the holidays, two members of the congregation whose homes were decorated blue and white rather than red and green had concrete blocks thrown through their windows. One of them landed on a child's bed. Fortunately, he wasn't in it. These were acts of destructive hatred aimed at Jews because they were Jews. They were designed to terrify and intimidate. The reaction of the congregant families was complicated, but the reaction of the community is what made this Billings Hanukkah story special. For in Billings, Montana, on the Great American Plains near the rolling Yellowstone River, not far from where Custer met his end at the hands of the Sioux, the entire town decided that this kind of anti-Semitic activity was not acceptable in the year 1993. As a community, Billings responded immediately. The Sunday after the second one of these attacks, the Billings Coalition of Churches passed out Hanukkah menorah stencils for schoolchildren to color and put up in their own windows. And by golly, they did it. Suddenly, menorahs bloomed in every child's window in Billings. A local sporting goods store put up a big marquee sign, "No hate in our town," made a great picture in the newspaper. That newspaper told and retold the story of the family's experiences and responses. Now, a few Christian families who put up Hanukkah decorations to go with their Christmas ones, supporting the Jewish community, had their Christmas decorations vandalized, but that only served to highlight the fact that anti-Semitism is also anti-religious, that it was hatred based in ignorance and stupidity. Those acts served to unify the town's extraordinary response even more. Billings became the place where the Christmas menorahs meant more than any trees did. The Friday night when I next returned to Billings from Cincinnati, we held a rally in the parking lot outside the small temple building. Hundreds and hundreds of people came and lit candles and sang. We talked about tolerance and freedom of religion and conscience and acceptance. When our small congregation in Billings went into the temple, filling it to capacity for our Hanukkah Shabbat service, the rest of the large crowd surrounded the building, leaning close to the open windows on the cold night to follow our prayers, songs, and words, and to protect us. It was an amazing show of solidarity. It didn't end with Hanukkah. Friendships and bonds of understanding were forged in Billings, Montana, in response to those Hanukkah events. I was asked to lead a Passover Seder at the Catholic Church, to sing and speak on Jewish music at the American Lutheran Church, to head a new interfaith clergy group. Our congregation's members became emissaries of understanding and experience, not just of tolerance, but of real understanding throughout Billings. Hate was conquered in that city then. And the religious freedom that is at the heart of the Hanukkah story was affirmed with vigor and commitment. I will never forget those paper menorahs in everybody's window. So what could be a better Hanukkah story? Well, in this year, when we've seen violent anti-Semitic acts taken against American synagogues, kosher markets, when we have witnessed an awful resurgence of vicious anti-Semitic rhetoric, both on the right and the left, it's heartening to remind ourselves that good can and should triumph over evil. There is tremendous support for the Jewish community in America and great reservoirs of American decency that remain to be tapped and should be. Examples like Hanukkah and Billings back in 1993 remind us of that, bring us back to that time and our current need. To complete this Hanukkah segment to open up today, here's the classic Hanukkah song Ma'oz Tzur in a light new version by Yonina.
Ma'oz Tzur Yeshuati Chana Leshambea Tikon Beit Tefilati Visham Toda Nezambea Le'et Achim Matbea Mitzah Menabea Azek Mo Chanukah HaMizbeach, as a gemara, Beshir Mizmor.
Ma'oz Tzur, the Rock of Ages for Hanukkah, with its message of religious freedom and liberation from repression. Our guest this morning, Brooke Goldstein, knows a lot about that. She saw an important need for Jews and Israel and met it remarkably well. Her organization is called the Lawfare Project. It's fascinating. Find out how it works when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Brooke Goldstein is the executive director of the Lawfare Project, a fascinating program that uses the law to protect the rights of Jews and supporters of Israel really all around the world. The Lawfare Project is a nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness and facilitating a response to the abuse of Western legal systems and human rights laws, in particular against Jews. Brooke, tell us how you got into this. This is not what every lawyer does.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. In terms of how I got into it, basically the short story is I used to work as in-house counsel for Daniel Pipes at the Middle East Forum, and I was helping to run a legal defense fund where we financially supported and arranged for pro bono legal counsel for anyone in the counter-terrorist world or moderate Muslims who were sued for speaking publicly about national security threats and theologically motivated terrorism. And doing that, I realized that we in the Western world, and especially Israel, was on the front lines of what we termed a lawfare attack, which is a legal attack against our rights, against our freedoms. You see this often in the West, where, again, people are sued for exercising their First Amendment rights to free speech about issues of national security, but also especially Israel, where the law is used to undermine Israel's ability to operate on the asymmetric battlefield. I'm talking about war crimes charges filed against Israeli officials so they can't travel throughout Europe without fear of an arrest warrant, false charges of human rights violations, attempts to bring Israeli officials before the International Criminal Court, and so forth. And I realized there was a very well-funded legal campaign to undermine us and undermine our ability to defend ourselves against terrorists. So when I left the Middle East Forum after about 2.5 years, I wanted to work for a Jewish litigation fund because I wanted to help defend those who are attacked, but also at the same time, and I'm sure your audience is very aware, there is an uptick in anti-Semitism. There are rampant human rights and civil rights violations occurring against Jewish communities around the world, and I wanted to work for a Jewish civil rights litigation fund, you know, a pro-Israel ACLU. I wanted to help organize a legal offense to protect and to uphold the civil rights of Jewish communities. And there wasn't one. So in 2010, I established the first ever Jewish Civil Rights Litigation Fund. And since then, we have recruited over 400 lawyers around the world. We have filed over 80 groundbreaking civil rights lawsuits on behalf of Jewish communities around the world. And we have managed to have just under $5 million of pro bono legal support donated to Jewish communities internationally. So that's basically the short story of how I got into it.
It's a pretty good story. We will hear much more from Brooke Goldstein, the executive director of the Lawfare Project, about the specific cases that they're involved in and some of the work they've done and are doing right now when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter, Hanukkah this coming week especially, but Shabbat every week. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community and the fastest-growing synagogue in southern Arizona, striving every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area. We have weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha will be located for just one more week at 7315 North Oracle Road, north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road for Shabbat Hanukkah evening services at 6:30 p.m., with Saturday morning Torah study at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat Hanukkah morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. But next week, with the new secular year of 2020, we move into our new digs at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, just at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. We aren't in the mall, but on the south side in our own building, and we'll be there for a while. Join us in 2020 on Ina, west of La Cholla, Congregation Beit Simcha. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Tat Kabbalat Shabbat, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, that's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson, or call 520-276-5675, that's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona, its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18 at gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from 2JewishRadio.com or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as wonderful podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Brice. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And an early happy Hanukkah, Chag Sameach.
Thank you.
We started talking last week about this conference in Montenegro where you presented a very interesting kind of unexpected place to have this take place, and you built up some of the story based on the founder. Tell us some more.
Right. So the founder was Yasha Alfandari, who unfortunately died a few years ago. But not before seeing the first annual one of these conferences, always in Budva, this beautiful town on the coast, in a big hotel that's right on the water. So you get all the scenery. But after the season, it's always held in late October, so there aren't hordes of tourists. Actually, the first couple of days we were there, it was still warm enough that people could swim in the sea and could sunbathe.
Nice.
And then it started raining and getting a little bit colder. But so the conference itself, you need a piece of background to understand this. What used to be Yugoslavia is now a bunch of separate countries. Montenegro, Northern Macedonia, Kosovo, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Slovenia, etc. And to some extent, some of these countries are even further subdivided. So it's a very confusing hodgepodge. And there was a lot of economic turmoil and then internal warfare. The economic turmoil mostly in the 80s, the military warfare in the 90s, and a lot of bright, young, ambitious people, including Jewish people, left the country. And they left for all over the world. There's a huge diaspora of people from former Yugoslavia, whether in Geneva or Brussels or London or Frankfurt or Israel, Australia, the US, Canada. They're all over. So one of the ideas of this conference was to bring people back once a year to a pretty part of their former homeland and have them talk about Jewish issues. And there's a European association of rabbis, and there's this and that, and eventually lots of these organizations helped to sponsor the conference financially, in order, if nothing else, to buy a slot on the program. So I found it interesting that most lecturers were promoting either an institution or a place or a viewpoint or whatever. I was one of the few lecturers who wasn't selling anything. And I was the only lecturer from our side of the Atlantic. The others were former Israeli generals or Israeli ministers, or in a few cases, there was a guy who talked about Jewish cultural tourism, but in fact, he was a former official of the state travel agency in Hungary. And his talk was very technical, like how much it costs to get into this site and what the money's used for and why Jewish tourists shouldn't feel ripped off when they're asked to pay to go into a synagogue in Eastern Europe. Not for me the most interesting subject, but it gave me a great transition into my talk, which was on the recent increase in violent anti-Semitism almost worldwide and how different governments are responding to it differently. But back to the conference itself, because this is what I found so interesting. The opening ceremony anointed or enthroned or enshrined or elected or appointed, whatever, a new chief rabbi of Montenegro for the first time ever. Since there was never a Jewish community, there was never a rabbi, certainly didn't need to have a chief rabbi. Well, this is a guy who was born and raised in L.A. and speaks English with a Yiddish accent. Chabad, part of the sort of Chabad Foreign Service Corps, which does great jobs everywhere, and we've talked about them before, but he was only a small part of the opening ceremony. There was also the Israeli Minister of Religion, there was the President of Montenegro, and there were a bunch of other people. And so that brings us to the next question, which we'll talk about next week. Why all this interest?
Indeed. Indeed. Really good question. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Inbal Shtivi, our shlicha on Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Ol.
Chagurim Sameach. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. Chagurim Sameach. Yes.
So there's an open house coming up?
Oh, yeah. First of all, let me tell you that Hanukkah is my favorite holiday.
Yeah. A lot of people's, a lot of Jewish people's favorite holiday. One of my favorite holidays.
So I'm like
too.
My people. I love Hanukkah. It's my favorite holiday. I love donuts. I love the food. I love the family gathering. Oh, I'm going.
And the candles. It's all good.
It's all good.
I totally agree.
And the songs.
Absolutely. Yeah. All the music. So the 26th
at 4 o'clock, we're going to have an open house, Hanukkah edition, in my residence.
Very nice. Everybody's invited to your house.
Everybody's invited to my house, 4 o'clock. All the details are on Jewish Tucson, on Weintraub Israel Center Facebook page, so you can see exactly how to get there.
All right, so we will. My family will come, and then we'll come home and celebrate my daughter's birthday, which took place on the 25th, and Hanukkah. So everybody should also celebrate my daughter's.
So maybe we can collaborate on this one. You come.
This sounds good.
Yeah, please. I'll be happy to add this content.
I'll bring my sweet potato latte.
Yeah, so we'll spin dreidels, we'll light candles. It'll be a family
songs
and it will be great. Yeah.
So I want to ask a very different question than Hanukkah, which is in Israel, there hasn't been an official government now since the spring of 2019.
That's true.
So how do things work?
There was a government. It's a transition government.
Transitional government. Okay,
yeah.
So it isn't it's an official transition government.
Yeah, but it's not an operative looking
government
to the future. Yeah.
So that must cause some challenges, but are there opportunities that emerge because of this weird situation?
I think that one can see opportunities. I think that one of the opportunities that I can see, at least, or one can see, is the rise in power of the municipalities, or the possibilities that municipalities have when a government is not as effective as before. For example, just a month ago, started a new service in Tel Aviv and the metropolitan area with several neighbor cities of free transportation on Shabbat, which
we talked about here on Too Jewish. You know, suddenly you can get the bus in Tel Aviv and a couple of the outlying areas around Tel Aviv, which was a huge change.
It is a huge change. I'm following on the municipality reports on how many users and what's the progress. Already they have doubled the amount of seats available, because
it's free travel. Right?
It's free travel.
Shabbat, you don't spend money, but you can move from place to place.
But you can move from place to place. It's for the women without cars. It's for youth that can go hang out and enjoy their weekend without spending too much money on taxis. It's for the elderly who need to go to visit their friends, maybe in hospitals or elderly facilities. It's for those who don't have a car.
Right.
And usually would be very much limited in their movement opportunities.
So that was really only possible because it's a transitional government.
Because I think that the fact that there is no, that everybody's somehow busy with the election and with the political situation that is very, very complex.
It is indeed.
It's just not a priority to counter this initiative, for example. So this, I think that this is one of those things that were only possible because there is no acting government.
So, it's funny. We think about how this has been this endless loop of no official government or no permanent government, but in some ways there have been some opportunities to change Israel in ways that would never have been possible without this.
Yeah,
and maybe for the good.
And maybe I must say something that maybe it was always an opportunity waiting to happen, and it's just a coincidence that it happened now.
Maybe. But we'll take it.
No one knows. Yeah.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Come to the Open House.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As the plane settled on the tarmac at Ben-Gurion Airport, the voice of the captain came over the loudspeaker. Bruchim habayim, welcome to Israel. Please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the plane is at a complete standstill and the seatbelt signs have been turned off. To those who have remained quietly in your seats, we wish you a Merry Christmas. To those of you standing in the aisle struggling with your suitcases, we wish you a Happy Hanukkah. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and don't get up before the plane stops. The wonderful Festival of Lights and Latkes, Hanukkah, is coming up tonight, running for 8 crazy nights. Congregation Beit Simcha celebrates its first anniversary as a synagogue and the seventh night of the Festival of Religious Freedom with the elegant We Are One event, a night to remember. Join us for a fabulous evening of delicious Hanukkah food, champagne, and wine at a spectacular home overlooking all of Tucson, Saturday, December 28th at 5 p.m. We'll celebrate Hanukkah with glowing candles, delicious latkes, songs, enjoy great entertainment, a silent auction, and much, much more. Details are on the Congregation Beit Simcha website, beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, that's 276-5675. Don't miss this incredible evening of joy, entertainment, and friendship. We are one. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy, representing the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Chag Chanukah Sameach, Chag Orim Sameach.
Chag Orot Sameach.
Yes, well, it's Orot, right? So it's the holiday of lights.
Orim.
Yeah. I thought it was Orim, yeah. Thank you. Well, I didn't want to correct in Israeli and Hebrew, but... and then people say Chag Urim Sameach, although right. It's really, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Let's not spend too much time on grammar here. Nobody's interested in grammar. But Hanukkah, everybody's interested in. Tell us what Hanukkah is like in Israel for you guys.
So for me, Hanukkah in Israel,
And not Hanukkah, but
right, Hanukkah. Right. Hanukkah. I like Hanukkah a lot. First of all, I like sufganiyot.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, sufganiyot, for those who don't know, are kind of like jelly donuts, but denser, worse for you, and really only available around the time of Hanukkah. In Israel.
Right, right. I'm not like here in every place in the States.
Yeah, you donuts. Get donuts everywhere, yeah. But it's not really a donut.
Yeah, it's not. It's not. It's better. So I really like sufganiyot. I like. I eat every day like 4 or 5 of them, but I don't care.
That's
really
because
much.
You're 18 years old. Yeah. Trust me, the rest
I
of
I can't remember the last time I had a sufganiyot.
So well,
compared
you'll...
to you.
So I like that amount of every day. Also, the lighting candles with the family. You know, we just sing the songs, and then we light the candles, and then we watch television together or do something. And just the atmosphere, like every holiday, it's, I like it really a lot.
So it's very family-oriented, very home-oriented. You know, one of the things when I lived in Jerusalem, everybody put their Chanukiah, not menorah, their Chanukiah, the Hanukkah candelabrum, in, they'd certainly put them in the window, but sometimes they had these outside glass boxes that they would actually put them in so that they could burn. I don't think that happens so much in Tel Aviv or on the Moshav where you're from, Danielle, but tell us about Chanukah for you.
Well, for us, it's pretty much lighting the candle every time. It's like in a different place.
Oh, you move it to a different part of the house each time?
No, it's always on the window. We just remove ourselves.
Oh, okay.
And it's always in a different family, friend's house that we light the candles with them. And then we eat latkes.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Levivot.
Levivot. Yeah. Well, I don't eat the sufganiyot. I enjoy looking at them, but I don't eat them. But
that's a very good nutritional choice.
I try.
But a big mistake. I'm sorry.
Well, I know.
So levivot in Israel, they're just really potato pancakes, right? They don't make them with zucchini or sweet potato or chili or any of the other
just
kinds
onion.
That you can make here.
Just like the potatoes.
How many Chanukiyot do you each have in your homes?
I just have 2, to be honest.
I think 4, something like that.
Yeah, one for each person, maybe, or just, you know.
Yeah, just for decoration.
Yeah, so you don't collect them like I do and like a lot of Americans do for decoration purposes.
No.
Listen, Hanukkah is, I think, a wonderful holiday. Does it have an important military aspect in Israel?
Military?
I don't think that, like, any holiday have a military aspect in it. For example, here and also all the sports games, so each sports game, like military service,
There's a lot of military overtones. And in Israel, where everybody serves in the military, they kind of leave it out of other things.
Yeah, so it's not like really connected to any holiday or something. We do have that thing that we collect things on Purim or something for the soldiers.
For the soldiers, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But not like really...
Yeah, not even though Hanukkah is really celebrates a military victory, that's not how it's played in Israel.
Right.
No.
Fascinating.
No. A lot of soldiers stay in their bases and keep our lives safe.
All right, well, Danielle, your assignment is to have at least one sufganiyah this Hanukkah.
It has to be worth it.
Yeah.
It can't be. I don't like the like boring.
All right, I might have to make them for you just for that.
Okay, I'll be waiting for it.
Listen, Chag Hanukkah Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. In this week's portion of Miketz, we are in the midst of the fabulous story of Joseph, shorn of his technicolor dream coat now, and locked away in an Egyptian prison. Dreams play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis, not even for the first time in this Joseph story. In Miketz, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. 7 fat cows emerge from the Nile River, then are eaten by 7 skinny cows. Then 7 fat ears of grain are devoured by 7 lean ears of grain. What does it all mean, he wonders. None of the Egyptian king's brilliant advisors and counselors can help him. In desperation, he turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once helped his chief wine steward, his bartender, if you will, when he was in jail. Joseph is dragged from prison, cleaned up, brought to the Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world. He hears the dream and correctly interprets it, prophesying 7 years of plenty to be followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God for being his only source of insight, Joseph helps the Pharaoh save Egypt, and things go well, both for Joseph and Egypt. He rises to great prominence, second in command of the country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied, while the people of Egypt are saved from destruction. Joseph marries and has two children, but oddly, his great success, his fame throughout Egypt, his new family even, aren't quite enough for Joseph. He misses his father, left behind in Canaan, pines for his younger brother Benjamin, the only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. He never expects to see his father and full brother again. He misses his Hebrew identity, too. I guess you can take the boy out of Canaan, but you can't really take the Canaan out of the boy. And then, in a plot twist worthy of the finest novelist, his brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread to eat. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are completely in his, Joseph's, power. What an amazing opportunity for revenge. And Joseph seems to take advantage of that. He teases and torments his brothers, he fully aware of their identity, and they completely ignorant of his. What will happen? As the Torah portion concludes, we're left wondering just which way it will all go. Next week, we get the answer, but this week, the issue is clearly delineated. How exactly will an assimilated Jew respond to direct pressure to hide his identity? Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation and give up their Judaism, so Joseph struggled with hiding his identity or admitting it in public. In a season in which the majority culture can overwhelm us with its songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews, too, sometimes struggle to assert our pride in our own Jewish identities. May we learn from the lesson of Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity must be asserted proudly and with commitment and publicly in all times and seasons. Our guest this morning, Brooke Goldstein, founded the Lawfare Project, and it's turning the tables on the legal assault on Israel and Jews all around the world. Hear all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Authorities arrested a 24-year-old Pennsylvania man last week for committing awful vandalism at the Nessa Synagogue in Beverly Hills, California, last Shabbat. Beverly Hills police arrested Anton Nathaniel Redding of Millersville, Pennsylvania. They caught him in Hawaii and charged him with vandalism of religious property and commercial burglary. Those charges include a hate crime penalty enhancement. The Nessa Synagogue security staff arrived for their shift early last Saturday morning and found the place had been ransacked, Torah scrolls desecrated, furniture damaged. The staff alerted the police that nothing appeared to have been stolen. The suspect damaged several Jewish relics, but fortunately the synagogue's main Torah scrolls survived unscathed, Beverly Hills police said. The cowardly attack hit at the heart of who we are as a community, said Beverly Hills Mayor John Mirisch. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, tweeted that he was shocked and outraged over the vandalism. We will stand together and speak out strongly against any act of hate and intolerance in our community. Authorities quickly identified Redding as the suspect as a result of a thorough investigation, review of surveillance footage, and the processing of forensic evidence, according to the police department. A warrant was obtained for his arrest. Investigators, along with the crime impact team, shifted their focus to locating him. Beverly Hills police determined Redding was in Hawaii, and they traveled there, working with local Hawaiian authorities. He was located in Kona on the Big Island of Hawaii and taken into custody rapidly. Redding is being held without bail. He will remain until an extradition hearing from Hawaii is held to authorize his transfer to the state of California. Once it's approved, he will be transferred from Hawaii to L.A. Beverly Hills police worked in cooperation with federal and local law enforcement agencies. We must here on Too Jewish commend the rapid work of the Beverly Hills Police and other authorities involved in arresting this awful perpetrator of a hate crime against Jews. The Beverly Hills Synagogue was established in 1980 to serve Iranian Jews, many of whom fled religious persecution following Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979. City of Beverly Hills calls Nessa the largest Persian Jewish congregation in the U.S. About 20% of the city's 34,000 residents have Iranian heritage. Local residents, some of them congregants of the synagogue, went on social media expressing distaste and fear from the attack. What does it mean to be a Beverly Hills Jew in 2019, said local resident Ted Fletcher. It feels like a sin posting photos of this. This is not Poland in 1930. This was taken yesterday in Beverly Hills. This vandalism follows more than a year's worth of nationwide attacks and threats on locations associated with Jewish communities, including the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting in October 2018, the hate crime shooting at the Poway San Diego County Synagogue last April, the plot to blow up a Colorado synagogue that was thwarted and revealed last month, and last week's deadly attack on the New Jersey kosher supermarket that resulted in the death of a police officer and three people in the kosher market. Well, following up on last week's atrocity, more details have now emerged. The perpetrators were connected to a black nationalist extremist sect called the Black Hebrew Israelites, not to be confused with those African Americans who consider themselves Jews. These two, I don't know how to describe them, terrorists, I guess, fired hundreds of bullets inside the J.C. Kosher supermarket in a siege that lasted over 2 hours and left three civilians and the policeman dead. The store owner, Leah Mindel Ferenc, was 33 years old, a mother of three. Her husband had left the store just moments earlier to go to pray his afternoon prayers at a nearby shul. The body of a 24-year-old rabbinical student, Moshe Deutsch, was riddled with bullet holes. Store employee Douglas Miguel Rodriguez, 49 years old, had a daughter. He was shot and killed after holding the store's back door open so that Deutsch's cousin could escape. Detective Joseph Seals, who was 39 years old, was killed by the perpetrators in New Jersey in a nearby cemetery. He had previously gone there to meet a confidential informant. A fundraising campaign by the Jewish community raised more than $50,000 for his family in less than 24 hours. A fundraising effort to support the Ferenc family aimed higher. That campaign raised more than $1.2 million of its $1.5 million goal already. Security has been increased throughout the area, really throughout the whole New York and New Jersey region. Many Jews are expressing fears of even going to the kosher markets. This seems like a bad dream of European oppression, not the way we have long lived in the land of the free. Frankly, it has been a hell of a year for anti-Semitism in America. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Brooke Goldstein is the executive director and founder, I should also note, of the Lawfare Project, which works to not only defend but protect Jewish rights and those who defend Israel all around the world. Brooke, you're also a filmmaker and author. Tell us a little bit about that, too.
So I actually started, I would say, my legal career doing a film about human rights abuses against innocent Palestinian Muslim children. I spent 2 years with my co-producer, Alistair Leyland, going in and out of Jenin, Ramallah, Tulkam, Nablus, and some surrounding areas, securing firsthand interviews with leaders of designated terrorist organizations, families of child suicide homicide bombers, children who were arrested for either attempting to blow themselves up or participating in violent activities, all in an effort to raise awareness about what I thought then and still believe now to be the number one greatest human rights violation of our time, which is the state-sponsored illegal incitement and recruitment of innocent Muslim children towards violence. I did my law school essay, my third year law school essay on the subject, you know, arguing that this is really the root cause of terrorism, because after 9/11, I was in New York for 9/11. I noticed everyone kept asking themselves the same question. What did we do to deserve this hate? why do people hate us so much that they're willing to kill themselves and kill thousands of other innocents in the process? And I believed, and again, still believe now, that this is the wrong question. The right question is, why are millions of Muslim children being taught in their school textbooks by their religious leaders, by their political leaders, sometimes by their parents, to love death and to hate life and to aspire to martyrdom for the sake of jihad or the sake of Allah? And is this not a human rights violation? Is not the teaching of children from infancy to kill themselves a form of child abuse? You know, and one subject, well, the main character of the film, actually, Hussam Abdu, the film is called The Making of a Martyr. We won the Audience Choice Award for Best Film at the United Nations Documentary Film Festival back in 2006. It focuses on this child, Hussam Abdu, who is a physically handicapped, he was rumored to be mentally handicapped, Palestinian Muslim boy who was paid the equivalent of $20 to blow himself up, recruited by the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade. And it was a very compelling story for me. So I did a documentary film on that, and it really launched my career into the world of counterterrorism and human rights law.
In addition to dealing with counterterrorism and human rights laws, you've dealt with certain economic issues with lawfare, the labeling of Israeli products in Europe, certification of Israeli products by the European Union. Can you explain those cases a little bit?
Sure. I'll say, though, to start, the whole so-called BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, I spoke about lawfare as the legal attack. There's also the economic attack. And this movement is being couched in human rights language, but what it really does, what BDS does, is advocate for unlawful commercial discrimination against persons because of their protected categories, because of their nationality, because of their race, ethnicity, or national origin. So, for example, let's say I had a problem with, you know, Iranian nuclear disarmament or Chinese foreign policy or Russian foreign policy, let's say. I don't turn around and advocate for discrimination in the commercial context against a local Muslim person or a local Chinese or Russian person to punish them for the actions of a government happening thousands of miles away. But that's exactly what BDS does. It says, well, we have a problem. We have a position on the so-called Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or we have a problem with Israeli foreign policy. So, hey, you Jew, or you Israeli, I'm going to boycott you. I'm going to punish you. I'm going to advocate for discrimination against you because of your nationality, because of your religion. That's racist, and it's illegal. It's illegal in the United States. And so we have brought several cases against the perpetrators of this type of illegal commercial discrimination, both here in the United States and abroad. One of the cases that you mentioned is the labeling case. In Europe, and again, to make a long story short here, there was a decision by a European Trade Commission, which was adopted as law by certain European countries and now by the European Court of Justice, that Jewish products originating from Judea and Samaria should be labeled as such. Muslim products or Christian products from the same geographic location don't have to be labeled, but Jewish products, products made by Jews, have to be labeled because Jews are illegal foreigners in Judea and Samaria. It does not get more racist than that. So we were retained together with an incredible team of attorneys, including Mayor Gabe Groisman here in Florida and Covington as well, to represent Sugoat Winery, which is an award-winning winery in Judea and Samaria, to challenge this type of illegal labeling and illegal commercial boycott of Israeli products.
There are some obvious cases, and we're running close to out of time, but I want to touch on one other set of cases which seem really blatant. The denial of flights to Israeli nationals on Kuwaiti and Saudi Airlines, which you guys fought. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, again, this is an example of a state-sponsored boycott against persons. And especially, you know, when it comes to sports and gaming, where politics are supposed to be swept aside in favor of camaraderie and sportsmanship. I mean, that's the whole point of international tournaments, of the Olympics, where people of all different faiths and religions and nationalities come together and compete based on merit. They put aside politics and they come together. It's a beautiful thing. And yet what we saw, for example, with Saudi Arabia and what we're still seeing is very alive today is the original Arab League boycott of the 1970s, where the Arab League states and pretty much every Muslim majority state refuses to do business with Israeli nationals out of really an archaic and prejudicial stance and feeling that they have to economically boycott Israel. They will never succeed. You know, Israel is economically stronger than it's ever been, and it's an age-old prejudice that they just refuse to get rid of. And so we saw this, for example, in the chess tournament, where Saudi Arabia was allowed to host a tournament a couple of years ago and denied a visa entry to the Israeli chess players, world champions. And they couldn't come and play. So we were retained by an Israeli chess champion. And we petitioned with FIDE, which is the International Chess Federation, saying that not only was it a violation of FIDE rules and regulations, but it was also a violation of Swiss law, which is where FIDE is incorporated to engage in that type of discrimination. And I think because of our efforts, together with the efforts of several other groups as well, FIDE canceled the chess tournament in Saudi Arabia, and they also granted Israel the right to hold a tournament that I believe just happened or is just about to happen. And they did the right thing, and they should be commended for doing so.
I want to thank Brooke Goldstein for a great visit. I feel like we could go on forever. You're doing remarkable work with the Lawfare Project. Where can people go to find out more and to see how they can assist?
Well, thank you for helping to expose these issues. Everyone should feel free to visit our website. It's thelawfareproject.org, spelled L-A-W, F as in Frank, A-R-E, thelawfareproject.org. Please help support us. We are a 501c3 charitable organization. Donations are tax deductible. We need your help. We need to fund a legal defense of the Jewish community. The time really is now, and the truth and the law are on our side. We can win this battle if we work together to do so. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke. When we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Israeli professor Noah Levy, discussing the Israeli electorate. Boy, that's an interesting question. And Israeli culture today. Our playout this morning for the holiday of Hanukkah, which starts tonight, December 22nd at sunset, continuing for eight crazy nights, comes from the a cappella group 613. It's their new Hanukkah release, a Star Wars Hanukkah. May God and the Force be with you over this terrific holiday. My friends, may you have a Chag Urim Sameach, a happy holiday of lights, and a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy Hanukkah, of course. Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, always of peace.
Kiddushan, Kiddushan.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.